places. Everyone.
We're now broadcasting.
Roll the tape in. 3, 2.
A new audio drama.
Appaloosa Radio is where stories come alive.
Appaloosa Radio offers Unfamiliarity, an original audio story with light wings. I did overperch these walls. Four stony limits cannot hold me out. Cannot hold me out. Cannot hold me out. I did overperch these walls.
Appaloosa Radio offers Unfamiliarity, an original audio story. When I was in high school during the 1960s, I believed that I wanted to write. During my sophomore year, I took a creative writing course as my elective. 3 weeks into the course, we shared our first stories. Mine did not go well. Or at least that is what I thought then. I had written about going to a restaurant with my slightly older cousin, Dina, and being shocked that my cousin went behind the lunch counter to cook her own meal. I also wrote that the place was greasy and downright filthy. A regular pigsty. I swore I would never go there again. As the class critiqued my story, Mrs. Cornaby, our instructor, asked me some really hard questions that I could not answer. Why was I bothered that Dina had gone behind the lunch counter to cook her own hamburger? Did her familiarity with the restaurant bother me? Why? Had I been in the kitchens of other restaurants? Did I know whether this restaurant was dirtier than other ones? What made me think this restaurant was filthy? Give specifics. Provide details. Weave the specifics into your storyline. Use them to enhance the story's narration. As a sophomore in high school, I was deeply offended by Mrs. Cornaby's intense questions. So offended that I dropped the course and opted for advanced biology instead. Career-wise, advanced biology proved to be the better choice. I eventually earned my PhD degree in biopharmaceutical science, and then spent my entire career working for one of the world's major pharmaceutical companies, where I retired as a senior vice president for research in 2014. Still, I hankered to write. In my retirement, I have written over 200 stories and even have had a novel published. My genre is historical fiction, and I set most of my stories in the abandoned ghost towns of the West. To be honest, until a couple of months ago, I had not even thought again about my experience in Mrs. Cornaby's creative writing class. By chance, I found a website that connects old high school classmates. I spent an hour looking over the names and reading their posts about their current lives. I decided not to add my name to the Let's Connect list. Still, I began thinking about my high school experiences, and, as a now, moderately successful writer, I remembered my story about my cousin and the restaurant. Maybe, I thought, I could still find that piece. My mother was a pack rat who kept everything. I have a trunk in my garage full of stuff that she had held on to. Have not touched it in 25 years. Maybe, I thought, it might be worth looking through. There I found my high school varsity letter. Probably the hardest thing I did while in high school. We had a really good swim team, but I was not a great swimmer. I would race only when someone else could not go. The coaches would put me in a race, expecting me to lose, but racing me anyway to keep our opponents from getting freebie points. We won a couple of meets because I finished a race. Since I was never a regular, I had to be ready for long events, short events, medley, or for any stroke. No one ever cared about my times. They just wanted me to finish. We had practices early in the morning and then late in the afternoon, two a day. It was hard, both physically and psychologically. I often thought about quitting, but I did not. In the trunk, I also found my award from the YMCA, designating me as the Outstanding Young Man of the Year. I had organized summer day camps for kids, trained and supervised staff, planned all of the activities. I hope you will forgive a brief aside. The scariest day of my entire life happened when I led a group of campers to the Disneyland amusement park and one of the counselors lost a child. That day the park closed at 6 o'clock. We, Disney security and me, did not find the boy until after 9. He had hidden in a cave on the Tom Sawyer's Island attraction. Of course, that was in the days before mobile phones. So, I had 85 other kids and 9 counselors on a school bus waiting for us to find him. And, I was just 17. Thanks for your patience. As I dug deeper into the old trunk, I found a folio of my work during my school years. In it was the first page of the story I had written for Mrs. Cornaby's creative writing class. To be truthful, It did sound sophomoric. Yet, I could see what I had been trying to do. I wanted to make the restaurant a place that created a sense of terror, foreboding, horror. Unfortunately, my writing abilities were not sufficient to create such a moody feeling. I had described the restaurant in considerable detail, even down to a meticulous description of the ketchup and Tabasco sauce bottles placed on each table. I wrote about the lunch counter and its six red-topped stools, the blue and white checkered oilcloth table coverings, the worn linoleum floor, the creaky ceiling fan, and the kitchen right behind the lunch counter. I had used descriptors like despicable, filthy, pigsty, greasy, unwashed, and putrid. However, I had not created a scene that evoked terror and fear. What came through as I reread the piece was that for me, in high school, this was a place that was not familiar. Unfamiliar. It represented a place beyond my previous experience. I had not encountered one such. As they now say, it was a place beyond my comfort zone. Mrs. Elizabeth Russell Cornaby was herself a writer who had her plays performed in New York at several off-Broadway venues. I knew nothing of her experience before enrolling in her class. I did not know that she had graduated from Vassar, acted for a decade in some of Broadway's most successful dramas, written dozens of published short stories and completed two novels. She married Frank Cornaby, a well-known New York playwright who had come to Hollywood in the 1940s to do screenplays, two of which had been nominated for Academy Awards. In the later 1950s, Frank Cornaby had become seriously ill and his wife had to go to work to support him. She had found a position teaching English at our high school. Now in her fifth year at our school, she was allowed to pick up the two creative writing classes. My class was the introductory class. The advanced class was reserved for juniors and seniors. I look back on my sophomore self and realize what an amazing opportunity I missed by not completing Mrs. Cornaby's course. I also wish I could tell her in person that I now understand the nature and purpose of her questions. Unfortunately, I cannot. She died from emphysema in the late 1970s. Between every class, she rushed to the teacher's lounge for a quick cigarette. Since my retirement, I spend almost every Tuesday at our local public library. It is a very comfortable, modern building that houses many things other than just books. For example, you can now check power tools out of the library, and craft supplies, and cake baking pans, and movie DVDs, and original art to hang on your wall. It has Friday night movies, Sunday afternoon music concerts, and kids' birthday parties. However, for me, the best is the magazine reading room. To be sure, most magazines are readily available online. Yet, I still like going to the library and reading the printed versions of the news magazines. About 3 months ago, I saw an article in Time magazine that has stayed with me. It was an article about Detroit, more specifically about the cement block wall built in the early 1940s to divide the east and the west sections of the city. That's correct. A cement block wall erected to divide the city. The wall was funded by some of the city's largest real estate developers. It was designed to separate the city into a black half and a white half. Researchers have studied the impacts of the Detroit Wall and have concluded that its impacts were enormous. On over 200 dimensions, the white side of the wall was significantly higher, more positive, than the black side. Initially, house prices were similar on both sides of the wall, but after 20 years, the houses on the white side were worth two or three times those on the black side. The black side had streets with larger potholes, and the city crews that removed the snow from the streets did the white side weeks before doing the black side. The white side had more stores, better schools, less unemployment, and significantly lower crime. Far more white students went to college. The white side had more, and higher quality, hospitals. The white side had more parks, more theaters, and more churches. Life expectancy was lower on the black side. On over 200 dimensions, the white side of the wall was significantly higher, more positive, than the black side. As I said, the study of the impacts of the Detroit Wall remained with me for weeks. Then, I realized that my cousins, although neither African American nor Hispanic, lived on one side of a comparable wall and my brothers and I lived on another. My Aunt Harriet was my father's younger sister. Her husband, Ward McMurdy, had been my father's best friend during high school. They had even enlisted in the Army Air Corps on the very same day. However, the war separated them. My father learned advanced electronics and was quickly promoted. Ward attempted to become a pilot but was soon washed out. After that, the only flying he ever did was with a bottle of whiskey. After the war, both Ward and my father chose to come to Southern California and its booming economy. My father used the GI Bill to go to college and become an engineer. Ward McMurdy bounced around from job to job, working most often as an over-the-highway truck driver. In 1950, when I was born, my father started his career in electrical engineering. By 1950, Ward and Harriet McMurdy had two children, Dina in 1947 and Will in 1949. However, the marriage was anything but placid. Harriet had to go to the emergency room on several occasions because Ward had beaten her. Nonetheless, they had three more children, Rhonda 1951, Christine 1952, and Millie in 1953. Then in 1954, Ward McMurdy disappeared. My Aunt Harriet never heard from him again. Sometime between the birth of Rhonda and Christine, Ward and Harriet bought a house. More accurately, they made a down payment on a house and then began monthly mortgage payments. They bought a house in one of the fastest growing areas of California, a former farming community just east of Los Angeles. In 1940, Norwalk had a population of less than 5,000. By 1950, it had a population of nearly 40,000. Almost all that growth came from newly constructed flat-roofed, concrete block homes, which were later described as having an atomic bomb shelter style. The house that Ward and Harriet bought had two bedrooms, one bathroom, and a carport. It measured 1,100 square feet. It cost them $4,700. They made a $700 down payment and financed the remainder. Its only amenities? It came with one tree and a gravel driveway. In the early 1950s, there were thousands of young families buying similar homes, starting families, and beginning, what everyone believed, was the American dream in sunny Southern California. What made my Aunt Harriet's situation different was that she was a single parent with five children and no income. With my father's help, she found a job assembling electronic components at a large defense industry factory. She would work there for the next 54 years, assembling a variety of electronic components. When she retired, she was given a special award as the company's longest-serving employee. My father became an electrical engineer and began a long career at a defense contractor. His specialty was designing the avionics for high-performance military aircraft. He was well-paid and well-respected. In 1954, we moved to a nice, but modest home in Whittier. Then, in 1958 we moved to the Fullerton Hills area, buying the house that I always considered home. The house was custom built for my family and was on a hill with an unobstructed view of much of Orange County. We would sit on our large patio after a barbecue and watch the lights twinkle. More importantly, my two brothers and I each had our own bedroom. Later, we would add a pool and the three of us would spend untold hours in it. Four bedrooms. Three bathrooms. A pool. Three car garage. Unobstructed view. Custom home. No wonder when we sold it after my parents died, the real estate agent described it as a $1 million property. Even as a high school sophomore, I realized that my cousins lived in a distinct world. Yet, because I was familiar with mine, I felt I also knew theirs. I felt I knew enough about theirs that I could be judgmental about it. My neighborhood was good, high quality, secure, pleasant, friendly, helpful, decent, well kept. Theirs? Well, not so much. My father required that we visit his younger sister and her children every couple of months or so. I now realize that it was odd. We would visit them, but they never visited us. We would bring presents and birthday cakes, then descend on their small house for a day, with hugs and well wishes. Always, we would drive back home, just after it became dark. I can say with absolute certainty that neither my brothers nor I ever spent a single night at my aunt's house. Of course, it was too small for guests. My four girl cousins slept in a pair of bunk beds in the one bedroom. I remember my father buying the bunk beds and I remember him assembling them in Aunt Harriet's house. I remember that day so clearly because he kept commanding me to go to the car and get him a specific tool and sometimes I brought him the wrong one. One of the few days that my father ever yelled at me. Not just once, but again and again. So, my four girl cousins slept in the same room. My Aunt Harriet kept the other bedroom as her own. That meant that my cousin Will had to sleep in the living room on the couch. The house was too small for guests. However, there was yet another reason that we never spent the night. My mother was usually warm, caring, and very loving. Yet, whenever we visited my aunt, she became nervous and sometimes downright cross. Trips to my Aunt Harriet's house were not for her happy occasion. She asked me, but none of my brothers. Sort of a secret adventure for only us older kids. For my story, I had made the restaurant a location for horror and terror. In reality, it was no such place. A blue-collar restaurant opened probably in the late 1920s when Norwalk was still primarily a farming community. It was small and one person usually served as both the short order cook and the server. I now remember that Dina had said that it was owned by a couple. I am remembering the names Glenn and Connie. But I'm old in my memory. Well, for some reason, Glenn could no longer work in the restaurant, so Connie hired my cousin, Dina, to work in his place. Dina started working there when she was 15, and when she invited me for the hamburger, she had become the de facto restaurant manager. So, it was routine for her to go behind the lunch counter and fix her own food. She intended it as a special treat for me. A special hamburger she cooked just for me. As a soon-to-be sophomore, I did not understand her offer. Instead, I became fixated on what I saw as the deplorable, rancid, and greasy ambience of the place. So, Since she is now on my mind, I feel the need to complete telling Dina's story. At 17, she dropped out of high school and married a guy who was a sergeant in the army. They moved to Washington State where they lived in base housing. After that, I lost contact. I saw her again when she was 23. She was once more living with her mother, my Aunt Harriet. By then she had two children, no husband, no job, and a problem with alcohol dependency. She was a short woman who had gained considerable weight. She was practically as large around as she was tall. She only wore Hawaiian muumuus, very large, shapeless dresses. She smoked cigarettes incessantly. And, to my considerable annoyance, she yelled at her children almost all the time. I never saw her again. I subscribed to one of those family history computer programs. Recently, I searched on Dina's name and learned she died at age 47 from the complications of diabetes. She had three more children and seems to have married two, maybe three, more times. She is buried in Bullhead City, Arizona. I am guessing that she may have worked in one of the several casinos in nearby Laughlin, Nevada. Detroit had an actual concrete block wall separating its east region from its west. In the Los Angeles metropolitan area, there was no concrete block wall. The wall was invisible, but nonetheless quite real. My family's home was in the affluent Fullerton Hills of Orange County. We had excellent schools, fine shopping, good roads, ample recreation opportunities, and safe communities. Families who lived in my neighborhood drove nice cars, took interesting vacations, and sent their children to world-class universities. My five cousins lived in their mother's two-bedroom house in Norwalk. Their only car was an older, but very dependable Chevrolet that my aunt drove to and from her work. She left her house at 6:15 each morning and did not get back home until 5:45 in the evening, if the traffic was light. My cousins had to fix their own breakfast and get themselves ready for school. When they came home, they each had tasks they had to perform, but no one was there to supervise them. If my cousins wanted to go somewhere, they either walked or took a bus. Shopping was not close by. Going to the grocery store was a once-a-week event. After the necessary bills were paid, there was seldom anything extra to buy something special. For that reason, my cousins did not have a television until I was in the 8th grade. My aunt was adamant. If they could not afford it from the money she earned, they did not buy it. She never bought anything on credit, never missed a mortgage payment, food was always on the table, and the family had passable, but not exceptional, clothes to wear. Beyond those necessities, there was little left to buy anything else. As I reflect on my own growing up years, I see four major differences between us. First, my cousins spent large amounts of their time in unstructured, unsupervised activities. As the old song says, they had nothing to do. They often just wandered around and sometimes they would wander into trouble. There was no accountability structure for their time. That was not what I experienced. Even in elementary school, I came home, had the snack that my mother made for me, did all, I mean all, of my homework, and then was allowed to play in either our neighborhood park, or at a specific friend's house, or my own backyard. I was always under my mother's direct supervision, wandering around with nothing to do and or falling into trouble was not allowed. Second, I always had transportation available to take me to places. We had two cars. One my father drove to work and one my mother drove, often taking us to activities or opportunities. There was no one to take my cousins anywhere. Third, and this is very important, my friends were all like me. Hard-working, serious students who had many advantages and clear goals. My friends were almost always selected by my parents. They came from my classes at school, from my sports teams, from my community activities, from my church. None of my friends engaged in high-risk behaviors. Drinking alcohol, taking drugs, sexual activity or gang activity. Finally, I was involved with a variety of community activities. For me, these activities focused on my work at the YMCA, but also included my tutoring at local elementary schools, and working with service clubs on community projects, like our local 4th of July parade. My cousins had no such opportunities. My Aunt Harriet had 5 children. Only one graduated from high school, Rhonda. After graduation, she completed beauty school, and eventually saved enough money to open her own shop. Rhonda was also the only one of my aunt's children to attend a gala celebration that the corporation had arranged for my aunt's retirement. Rhonda's brother, Will McMurdy, was put into state prison when he was just 17. He had been the getaway driver during an armed robbery of a convenience store. The clerk suffered serious injuries that he never recovered from but did not die. Will served 9 years of a 20-year term. While in prison, he had learned body shop repair and was hired at a shop a month after his release. He was clean for the next decade. He even saved enough to buy into a partnership for the body shop business. Unfortunately, he was arrested less than a year after that for running a chop shop dismembering stolen cars into parts so they cannot be traced back to the original owner. He was given another 6 years. In prison, he was stabbed by a rival gang and is now a paraplegic confined to a wheelchair. Like his older sister, Dina, Will has become an alcoholic who also suffers from diabetes. Christine did not graduate from high school, but she inherited her mother's drive for hard work. She often worked at more than one job at the same time. Unfortunately, none of her jobs paid well. Christine married an older man who already had 4 children by his previous marriages. Christine and her husband had 3 more of their own. A very busy house. During the late 1980s, Christine's husband developed severe health issues and was unable to work, and so, Christine became the sole provider. Her husband eventually passed away in 1996. She now works on the night janitorial staff at a large, well-known, amusement park and owns a small house in Buena Park. Millie is for me a literal unknown. My only source of information about her comes from her older sister Rhonda, who always calls me on my birthday and sends me cutesy Christmas gifts. Always a surprise to see what she sends. According to Rhonda, Millie became involved with a not-so-good guy while Millie was still in high school. Rhonda told me that Millie was a heavy-duty drug user and that Millie used to perform in various strip clubs. Then, when Millie was about 25, she just disappeared. No one in the family has heard from her since. Rhonda thinks Millie was last known to be in Dallas, but she is not certain about the accuracy of the information. As they all now approach retirement age, only Rhonda has the financial resources needed for a so-called comfortable retirement, like the one that I now experience. Rhonda and her husband Paco own a very nice home in Palm Springs, which they use as their base for their many travel adventures and their very large recreational vehicle. Her Facebook page is filled with travel photos and with pictures of her dog Charlie. I have 2 brothers. Both attended prestige universities and have since had successful careers. Titus, my next youngest brother, went to Northwestern where he majored in finance, and after graduating opened his own consulting firm in Chicago. His clients include many Fortune 500 firms, and his company's website says they actively manage over $9 billion in investments. When he was younger, Titus seriously considered becoming a professional ski racer. Today, He uses that great sense of balance to surf the big waves in Hawaii's pipeline. He owns a vacation home just a half mile from his favorite surfing beach. My youngest brother, Tracy, is an engineer like our father. Initially, after graduate school, Tracy worked in academia, teaching aeronautical engineering. About a decade ago, he invented a drone aircraft and began a business manufacturing it. Now, his company manufactures about 10,000 a year. Tracy has left the university and devotes his time to his business activities. Tracy has a superior singing voice and has sung as a principal soloist in several opera productions. He has built a music studio onto his home and regularly hosts other artists in recording sessions. Both of my brothers have been successful husbands and fathers. Titus and Bridget have been married over 40 years and have raised three children to successful adulthood. They are now the happy grandparents of six grandchildren, two adopted. Tracy and Ginny have now been married 25 years, have two children and are expecting the arrival of their first grandchild. Both Tracy and Ginny had been married before, and both stayed single for some years after their divorce. They approached marriage cautiously. However, once they were certain, they developed an intense devotion for each other. Me? Well, Allison and I are approaching 50 years together. We have four grown children and four teenage grandchildren. We live in a very comfortable active retirement community in the Sierra foothills, about 30 miles northeast of Sacramento. Altogether, my brothers and I have fathered nine children, and our children have produced 10, soon to be 11, grandchildren. All our children and grandchildren have had success in school. None has gone to prison. All are either gainfully employed, in school, or actively pursuing their own engaging pursuits. They have purpose and focus. They relate well with others. They all appear to be on a path for success. The point I wish to make is a simple one. Differences in income and available resources persist well beyond one generation. I recently asked Rhoda how many of her siblings' children and grandchildren had attended college. She counted 22 children and her grandchildren. She said there could be more, but she did not know about Millie. Of those 22, she could only identify two who had gone to college. One grandchild had attended a local state university and graduated with a major in accounting. Rhonda said this granddaughter now worked for a bank. A second grandson had attended 2 years of community college and had studied criminal justice. He now works as a police officer in a medium-sized city. My brothers and I lived on one side of the invisible, but very real, wall. My cousins lived on the other side. Some may say that no such wall ever existed. So, I asked a friend who is a former real estate broker. He used the online metrics only available to realtors to compute the value of my aunt's house in comparison to the house I grew up in. He noted first that the schools in my neighborhood scored in the top 2% of all schools in the state. The schools in my aunt's neighborhood scored in the bottom 5%. And two of the three schools that directly served my aunt's house were currently under state-imposed sanctions because of a long history of poor achievement. 91% of the students entering the high school I attended graduated on time, and 88% attended college right after graduation. At the high school my cousins attended, currently only 31% of the entering students graduate on time. My friend shared that this was a significant improvement over the school's performance 5 years earlier when only 16% of the students graduated on time. Still only 7% of the school's students become full-time college students. My friend shared the serious crime rate for both properties. My former neighborhood had only 0.03 serious crimes per 100,000 residents. My aunt's house had 27.9 serious crimes per 100,000 residents. The difference? In my aunt's neighborhood, serious crimes occurred 967 times more often. Finally, he computed the estimated value for each square foot of the same house built on each of the two properties. In my aunt's neighborhood, that hypothetical house was worth $87 a square foot. In my former neighborhood, that same hypothetical house was worth $291 a square foot. However, I do not need statistics to prove that my cousins and I lived in very different places. I need only to point to the actions of my parents. They crossed over to Aunt Harriet's house out of family necessity, but neither my father nor my mother did so willingly. It was a trip that went from the familiar to the very unfamiliar. They were anxious and nervous while we were at my aunt's house. We always left before dark. And my cousins never visited us. We did our necessary family obligations and then rushed back to our home. To the side of the invisible wall that we were familiar with. To where we felt comfortable. I reread the story that I had written in my sophomore class. I remembered again the comments that Mrs. Cornaby had made. I was writing about something, some place, and some people I was not familiar with. I only knew life from my side of the wall. For that reason, the story did not seem authentic. It seemed contrived, invented, one-dimensional. I spent one afternoon trying to imagine my cousin Dina's experience, especially when she took me to her place of pride, the restaurant that she was managing. Try as hard as I could only visualize brief snippets. The organizing gestalt was missing. I just couldn't get the pieces to fit. Maybe it was from frustration. Maybe it was from curiosity. Maybe it was from long-held guilt. I don't know. Nonetheless, I decided to fly down to Southern California and go to the restaurant, the one where Dina had worked. I used the excuse that I was looking for background for a new story, but that was not true. I really did not know why I was going. When I told my wife about my trip, she insisted that I stay with my nephew instead of getting a hotel room. My nephew, Cameron, had followed his father into a career in corporate finance, and he had recently purchased and fully remodeled a home facing onto the beach in Newport Beach. My nephew and his wife welcomed me gladly, even if they did not understand the reason for my visit. They prepared the guest room and gave me access to their garage. It was soothing to open my windows and listen to the surf. Very soothing. The next day, I drove up to Norwalk and parked behind the building that had housed the old restaurant. Norwalk today is in many ways different from the place we visited in the 1960s. Back then, there were many thousands of small, inexpensive concrete blockhouses. Building the three major freeways that now cut the city into its major sections destroyed many of these houses. It has become, instead, a very industrialized city. Older concrete blockhouses have been replaced by acres of newer, concrete-walled industrial parks. Norwalk is also a city where English is not frequently spoken, and where coarse graffiti mark every available wall space. Yes, it felt very different from the places to which I have grown accustomed. A white-haired, Anglo, man in a Hawaiian shirt and cargo shorts is an unusual visitor. parked behind the old restaurant building. I found that the restaurant was now a taqueria that served primarily locals. Its walls were brightly colored and there was a new neon sign saying Bienvenido. The old tables with their oilcloth covers had been replaced by newer wrought iron ones that gave more room to walk around. However, the lunch counter stools remained unchanged as I remembered them. Behind the counter was what seemed to be the same flat-top grill and the same stainless steel hood. Where the old pie rack had been, the current owners had placed their salsa offerings. There was still room for only the one cook in the kitchen. When I visited, the cook and proprietor was a middle-aged Mexican woman who was from Jalisco. I know because the restaurant had a large sign advertising a beer that was brewed in Jalisco. I ordered a lunch plate and a beer and sat at the counter on one of the stools. Since there were only two other customers, I had a chance to talk with the woman. My Spanish is not very good, and her English is not much better. Still, we were able to start a conversation. Her name was Lucinda Gonzalez, and she owned the taqueria with her husband who was a construction worker. Our conversation gained considerably more depth when her daughter, also named Lucinda Gonzalez, came home from high school and joined our conversation. I told her I was writing a story about the old restaurant, and that years ago, my cousin had worked in it. Mrs. Gonzalez was more than willing to talk as she continued to work in the kitchen. Things would not get busy again until after 5 when most of her customers came in. Primarily men who either worked in one of the nearby factories or worked as gardeners. The Gonzalez family had saved for almost a decade to get the money to buy the taqueria. She had been a maid in a hotel and her husband had worked in construction. They now also owned a house just blocks from where my aunt had lived. He was working to fix it up. Maybe if they made it nice, they might get enough money to buy a larger home. Maybe even one in La Mirada or Anaheim. Mrs. Gonzalez told me that now their life was much better than it had been in Jalisco. Most particularly because things are so much safer in California.
Muchos hombres malos con armas.
Many bad men with guns. I learned that the younger Lucinda Gonzalez wants someday to attend college and to be a writer. I have one piece of advice for her. Only write about what you are familiar with.
With light wings, I did overperch these walls. 4 stony limits cannot hold me out. Cannot hold me out. Cannot hold me out. I did overperch these walls.
We don't need no thought control. A Palooza Springs Audio Theater is a creative collaboration whose purpose is to write, produce, and share original story content through webcast radio experiences.